original called Fried Bananas. Fried Bananas.
Greetings and welcome, America. Good morning to all contiguous 48 states in Sirius XM satellite radio land and to all those listening around the world. I am Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next 3 hours, you're going inside the issues here on Sirius XM 126 Urban View. Each week, I, along with my guests and members of my listening audience, discuss social, cultural, national, and international issues impacting the global village in which we live. This is live, rhetoric-free, call-in talk radio, so your participation is greatly appreciated and encouraged. Get your cup of coffee, your glass of juice, whatever you like to drink on a Saturday morning at this time. Let's dialogue, listen, and learn. The nationwide call-in toll-free telephone number is 866-801-TALK, 866-801-8255. 866-801-8255. There's a very interesting article in this week's Washington Post entitled "African Americans See No Progress in 50 Years. In some ways, they're worse off than pre-civil rights movement." It's written by Tracy Jan. A lot of the data in this piece comes from a report from the Economic Policy Institute. The article opens as follows. Convened to examine the causes of civil unrest in black communities, the Presidential Commission issued a 1968 report with a stark conclusion. America was moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. 50 years after the historic Kerner Commission identified white racism as the key cause of pervasive discrimination in employment, education, and housing, there has been no progress in how African Americans fare in comparison to whites when it comes to home ownership, unemployment, and incarceration, according to a report released this past Monday by the Economic Policy Institute. In some cases, African Americans are worse off today than they were before the civil rights movement culminated in laws barring housing and voter discrimination, as well as racial segregation. Now, not to get into the details of this report, we're going to do that in the next hour, but its premise being after the historic Kerner Commission identified white racism as the key cause of pervasive discrimination in employment, education, and housing, I believe this is the premise of my first guest's new book. He is a voice that I am always proud to say is a voice you hear regularly on this program. He holds the Moores Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He is the author of more than 30 books and 100 scholarly articles and reviews. Some of the titles include Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, The Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, Storming the Heavens, African Americans and the Early Struggle for the Right to Fly, The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press, Claude Barnett's Pan-African News and the Jim Crow Paradox, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, Confronting Black Jacobins, Race to Revolution. I mean, this brother is just such a prolific, prolific writer. He joins us to discuss his latest book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. Dr. Gerald Horn, greetings. Welcome back, as always, my brother, and thanks for going inside the issues.
Thank you for inviting me.
How are you this morning, sir?
Could be worse.
No question. So, am I right to draw a parallel between your book sort of as the historic basis or perspective on our current circumstance? I mean, because there are places in your book where you reference for example, how the treatment of enslaved women as an obvious precursor to sex trafficking of today. DeSoto crossing the Mississippi and clearing the land in the 1530s later became comfortable U.S. suburbs. So am I right to draw some parallels between that Washington Post piece and a fundamental premise of your book?
Absolutely, you are correct. I think that as I was writing this book, there was the aftermath of the tragic and unfortunate November 2016 election of Donald J. Trump. And many commentators were wringing their hands, trying to give an explanation for how this happened. Supposedly, it was economic anxiety on the part of the 63 million strong Trump base, which actually feeds into the canard, the false narrative that obviously the black community, which voted against Trump 9-1, must be doing swimmingly. Although, of course, this community, our community, too, is suffering economic anxiety, yet we did not opt for voting for Agent Orange. So I decided that in my writing, for which the research had been done, I should try to connect the past to the present, try to show that the origins of settler colonialism in the 1600s in North America involved a process whereby it was based upon the enslavement of Africans and the dispossession of Native Americans. But more than that, it involved the kind of co-optation of poor Europeans. And like Colin Kaepernick, the former San Francisco 49ers quarterback, I focus on Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia in 1676, when Nathaniel Bacon, a rather affluent chap, by the way, leads a revolt of the dispossessed, principally Europeans, poor Europeans, against London and English colonialism because they thought that London was not moving fast enough or aggressively enough to dispossess the Native Americans so that the poor Europeans could get their land. And therein, it seems to me, lies the so-called secret to what unfolded in North America. That is to say, it was from the beginning a class collaboration between poor and richer Europeans. And as of November 2016, you saw the latest class collaboration between poor and richer Europeans. And until you confront that ugly reality, which I know disrupts the narrative of black and white unite and fight, and that the poor of whatever ancestry should have enough commonality to unite against the 1%. But it hasn't worked out that way, I'm afraid, in hundreds of years in North America. And so obviously we need new narratives and new strategies.
Can you talk just briefly a little bit about your thought process and your writing process? Because you just said something that I find incredibly interesting. You said the research for this book had already been done. And then you said, so after the election of Donald Trump, you decided to put a slightly different approach to what you had researched. So could you give a little insight maybe to some of those struggling historians out there or struggling writers like myself, because you are such a systematic and scientific researcher and such a prolific writer. Could you give a little insight into your thought process for this book?
Well, I already had a basic outlook. I started off writing about 20th century African-American history and trying to explain the retreat of Jim Crow. And I found it necessary to put that in a global context, in the context of the Cold War struggle between Moscow and Washington. Mm-hmm. So when I started this book in the 1600s, I started with a similar premise that you needed to look at global forces. And so that's okay. What really drove me to focus a lot, interestingly, on Turkey, the Ottoman Turks. Mm-hmm. In the 1600s were a major power. Mm-hmm. And so I was always in my research trying to track down various items and facts about what was going on in Turkey and its enslavement of Christian Western Europeans as they sailed southward to try to enslave Africans. And that became a linchpin of the story. And likewise, when the Ottoman Turks were defeated in Vienna in 1683, you could hear a sigh of relief in Western Europe, because they felt that now they could sail more easily southward to Africa without running the risk of being enslaved themselves in North Africa and being sold into the slave markets of Turkey. And of course, at the time, I was following, that is to say, 2016, 2017, following what's going on in Turkey, knowing that President Erdogan of Turkey, whenever he comes to the United States, he meets with black Muslims. I mentioned that on this program more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Mentioned on this program more than once that his opponent, Fethullah Gulen, who is an exile in the hills of Pennsylvania, has opened a number of charter schools in black communities from the Atlantic to the Pacific, particularly here in Houston, from where I'm speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was all coming together in terms of my research. And then it came together on the printed page when I began to write.
Before we go into this break, there are three brief statements from your introduction, pages 10 and 11, that I want to read. And then when we come back, I'd like for you to elaborate. You write, "Reducing the present to capitalism is somewhat misleading, since today's status quo represents a complex melange of vestiges of slavery. The still exploited African population in the United States and elsewhere, capitalism, and the feudalism from which it emerged." You then go on to write, "As early as 1663, an observer in Suriname noticed that Negroes are the strength and sinews of the Western world. The enslaved, a peculiar form of capital encased in labor, represented simultaneously the barbarism of the emerging capitalism along with its productive force." You close with, "If one seeks to understand how and why it is that so many Africans reside in North America speaking a language with roots in Western Europe, an intimate understanding of the 17th century is a requisite." Again, that to me goes right to the EPI study and gives a historic premise of why we are and where we are today. I want to pick up on that on the other side. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Wilmer Leon here. We're at 15 past the hour. Inside the Issues is where you are. The apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean. Dr. Gerald Horne, H-O-R-N-E, is how it is spelled. This is a fantastic, fantastic book. And when you're done with this, you will have an incredible basis to understand from whence we've come and why we are where we are. With that, guess what? Love walked in. Lou Donaldson is who we're going to hear. It's a 1962 Blue Note release off of The Natural Soul. Do yourselves a favor, folks. Keep it locked right here, Sirius XM 126 Urban View. John Patton on organ, Hammond B3. Love Walked In. Off of The Natural Soul, 1962 Blue Note. Lou Donaldson, alto, leading the date. Tommy Turrentine, Stanley's brother, on trumpet. Grant Green guitar, Ben Dixon drums. Great album. Great album, The Natural Soul. Dr. Wilmer Leon here, and we're at, where are we, 19 past the hour. The apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean. Gerald Horne, H-O-R-N-E, is the author. Gerald, thank you so much for staying with me. I'm not going to read the whole thing again. I'll just read the final statement. If one seeks to understand how and why it is that so many Africans reside in North America speaking a language with roots in Western Europe, an intimate understanding of the 17th century is a requisite. Why is, because so many people, and I know you've heard this ad nauseum, so many people, man, Gerald, there you go with that slavery stuff again. Man, we're beyond all of that. It's 2018. I didn't own no slaves, and my daddy didn't own no slaves, man. Leave that alone, and let's focus on now.
Well, the people who are making that charge, that incendiary accusation, are residing in a society that was built upon a towering mountain of African bodies and cadavers. That is to say that I'm not the first person who has pointed out the intimate connection between capitalism and slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, Capitalism and Slavery was a book written by the founding father of Trinidad and Tobago and the former prime minister. I'm speaking of Eric Williams,
mm-hmm.
formerly of Howard University, by the way,
mm-hmm.
in a book that came out in the 1940s.
See, Eric Williams, I think, is how it's written in on the title, right?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, then there's Walter Rodney, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, the Guyanese scholar,
mm-hmm.
formerly who taught at the University of the West Indies in Jamaica and University of in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. And then Joseph Nnakori, who is still in the land of the living, unlike the previous two scholars, the Nigerian scholar,
mm-hmm.
Who teaches at the University of Rochester, Africa and the Industrial Revolution in England, which points to how, as England rose, West Africa sunk. And so people may want to avoid inconvenient truths, but I have noticed, by the way, that people who make that accusation, they do not tell our Jewish brothers and sisters to forget mm-hmm. about the Holocaust, even though it happened
mm-hmm.
or began 80-odd years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's ancient history, you know. And so why this double standard?
In fact, if you try to engage in that conversation, you will be brutally attacked and summarily dismissed amongst the land of intellectuals.
You might even lose your job.
Yeah.
And so, you know, obviously what we really need to focus on is why there's such a reluctance, unwillingness, and inability of some to focus on the ugly reality of settler colonialism, which, by the way, is a phrase that is even largely absent from the vocabulary of mm-hmm. those who consider themselves to be radical. And I think what that bespeaks is the ideological victory of those who constructed these United States of America, in which even their supposed staunchest opponents have been ideologically disarmed.
Why your title, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism? That word apocalypse by many could be interpreted as being quite incendiary. Why that term?
Well, I think it forces anyone who picks up the book and looks at the title to think about what befell the indigenous population of the Americas, not to mention the Africans. That is to say, not only was the indigenous population of the Americas dispossessed of their land, but as I point out, many of them were actually sold into slavery, not only in North America, but you can find Native American DNA all over the world, because these European settlers, when they engaged in their ethnic cleansing, they began to ship these indigenous people to the slave markets of Turkey, the slave markets all over the world. And that's not even to touch upon what befell Western Africa in particular, and also Eastern Africa, because I think we oftentimes forget how Eastern Africa was ensnared by the African slave trade. That is to say that the hailest and hardiest amongst the African populations were snatched and handcuffed and dragged across the Atlantic, leaving the sick and the elderly to fend for themselves. And it's difficult to understand what has befallen Africa today without understanding the destructive impact of the African slave trade. In fact, I think I just saw the movie Black Panther the other day,
mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons that movie is successful, one of the many reasons, is that it really sort of plays upon what everybody implicitly recognizes. That is to say, Africa has been systematically underdeveloped to the point where the idea of a modern African society seems like science fiction. And that particular point cannot be understood absent an understanding of the devastation of the slave trade followed by colonialism.
You mentioned the term settler colonialism and how that has almost been written out of our lexicon. And when you said that, that took me back to Agent Orange's State of the Union, where he was talking about a North Korean, Mr. Sung Ho. He says, "It was that same yearning for freedom that nearly 250 years ago gave birth to a special place called America. It was a small cluster of colonies caught between a great ocean and a vast wilderness, but it was home to an incredible people with a revolutionary idea that they could rule themselves, that they could chart their own destiny, and that together they could light up the world. This is what our country has always been about. This is what Americans have always stood for, always strived for, and always done." What I found interesting in that statement is that, first of all, I didn't hear a whole lot of people talking about that statement, but intentionally or conveniently omitted from that was that between that great ocean and a vast wilderness, there were people that had been living there for centuries called, we mistakenly call them Indians. He didn't talk about the Trail of Tears. When he talks about lighting up the world, he didn't talk about the power to generate that light was based upon the labor and the black bodies of Africans. He didn't talk about the Middle Passage. So to me, that's a very convenient way, as you talked about, the term settler colonialism doesn't even get mentioned.
Well, I think the point that you're raising so cogently also raises another point, which is that because of the establishment of the United States of America, and because many of us are struggling to put food on the table and make sure our children get to school on time, we've decided to accept a kind of an accommodation to what I would call left-wing white nationalism. Mm. That is to say that you basically accept many of the implicit premises that Mr. Trump made in his State of the Union address, and then you just try to get a cut of whatever you can out of the booty that is delivered to this country. But I think the election of Donald J. Trump and the disaster that it portends, not only for North America, but I would say for the whole world, forces us really to go back to the history of settlement in North America so that we can gain a clear understanding of how we got to the precipice of disaster with the election of Agent Orange, so that we can better fight back against Agent Orange. Because I agree with the German foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel, when he suggests that Trump, contrary to some of the opinions of our liberal friends, is not an anomaly or an aberration, that even if Trump disappears from the scene tomorrow, and given his diet, that may not be unlikely, Trumpism will survive for some years to come. And so therefore, he says Germany should adjust its foreign policy accordingly. I think you see a similar process taking place in Canada, but I don't see a similar process taking place necessarily in the United States of America, where Trumpism will be particularly destructive, because once again, we sort of accepted the implicit premises that he laid out in his State of the Union address for a people without a land and without a people. And the other kinds of mythology that undergirds the creation myth of the United States of America. But I think the time...
Not only the United States of America, but that's the same phrase that the Zionists use to rationalize their oppression of the Palestinians.
Well, of course. That tends to be a staple amongst the... those who put forward settler colonialism. That is to say, in order to justify the dispossession, they have to act like there were no people there in the first place. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of landed in mass and were able to take advantage of this new Garden of Eden. But that's fantasy. That's mythology. And it ill serves us as we try to not only understand how we got to the point of disaster, but also to dig ourselves out of this deep hole in which we find ourselves.
The apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean. Gerald Horne, H-O-R-N-E, is the author. We're at 30 minutes past the hour. We're going to pause here for a moment. A little more Love Walked In by Lou Donaldson. It's a 1962 Blue Note release. It's called, the title is The Natural Soul. Lou Donaldson on alto, Tommy Turrentine trumpet, Grant Green, yes, that's Stanley's brother, Tommy Turrentine on trumpet, Grant Green guitar, Joe Patton organ, Ben Dixon on drums. And I got to give a big shout out to my number one fan, Candace Pay, down there in Richmond, Virginia. And hey, folks, if you're not at Niecy's right now, you need to be there sometime soon, because that's where it's happening, at Niecy's Boutique in Mount Rainier, Maryland. I know they got the show on right now in Niecy's, and I'm giving a big shout out to the folks there. So with that, we're coming up on 31 past the hour. Keep it locked right here. Sirius XM 126, Urban View. That's Grant Green right there. Love Walked In is the cut. The Natural Soul is the CD. Lou Donaldson is the lead on the date, 62 Blue Note. Dr. Wilmer Leon here, Inside the Issues is where you are. The apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean is the book. Dr. Gerald Horne, H-O-R-N-E, is the author. And Gerald, thank you so much for staying with me. In chapter one, you start logically, as you should, but many wouldn't, your chapter, The Beginning. Let me read a couple sections from page 31. Dublin was Europe's largest slave market during the 11th century. Scotland, for example, was filled with English slaves. The Roman Empire, which once controlled England, trafficked in hundreds of thousands of slaves annually. In the previous millennium, slavery and the slave trade were rampant, a praxis in which the Vikings and Scandinavians excelled. This older version of slavery was tied intimately to war, with the former being the fruit of the latter. This did not bode well for Africa as Western Europeans developed the weapons of war. Conservatives and apologists, they love to talk about historic slavery as a justification or rationale for North American chattel slavery, but the two, in my opinion, couldn't be further from similar. Could you talk about why you started that first chapter with that analysis and why you think it's so relevant to do so?
Well, first of all, with regard to these discredited conservatives, you have to draw a distinction on the one hand between slavery as a mode of production, not unlike feudalism or capitalism or socialism, for example, where the state controls the means of production. The difference with the Western European slave trade into Africa that helped to build the Americas was the racialized version of slavery. And of course, the inability, generally speaking, of the enslaved to rise. I mean, for example, I mentioned in the previous segment the Ottoman Turks, mm-hmm. and the fact that they were enslaving everybody. I mean, they were enslaving the Western Europeans. They were basically enslaving anybody who wasn't a Muslim, mm-hmm. Quite frankly. And in fact, they enslaved quite a few Africans along the way. In fact, I'm toying with the idea of doing a book on the East African slave trade that, for example, led to one of the most significant slave revolts in what is now Iraq in the 9th century, for example. But you cannot overlook the racialized nature of slavery in the Americas, and in fact, how that was intimately tied to this new identity politics that is whiteness and white supremacy, which we are still dealing with in terms of its toxicity, and which these conservative myth makers refuse to acknowledge or confront.
Well, in fact, you're taking me a bit out of my sequence, but I think this is a great time to introduce in chapter 3, The Rise of the Merchants. You write on page 76, in the midst of contestation between mainland royalists and Cromwellians, the local Massachusetts militia allowed Native Americans, Africans, even Scots to enlist. A truer sign was to emerge in New England by 1656, when it was ruled that Africans and indigens, and only Africans and indigens, should no longer be trained in the use of firearms. What that section highlighted to me, and I'd like for you to talk about it, is one of the misperceptions that we tend to have is that slavery in North America started out racialized and was a constant level of racialization. But actually, the racialization grew over time out of what they perceived to be, they being the Europeans, perceived to be necessity. Is that fair?
Yeah. That's the point that I try to make about the importance of the 17th century. For example, those in your neck of the woods may be familiar with a black man by the name of Anthony Johnson, who in the early 17th century was a major slave owner in the Chesapeake region. But by the end of the 1600s, that was virtually impossible. And what I try to show in this book is how and why that took place. That is to say that the settlers in an early stage were heavily dependent upon indentured European labor, particularly those who had been defeated in war, Irish and Scots in the first instance, who were then sent to the Americas for a certain term to work. But at a certain point, the elites in London decided that that system was not working and they needed a new kind of labor system. One of the reasons was so much land was opening up that they had not contemplated, with the turning point being the English seizing Jamaica from the Spanish in 1655, which then, for various reasons, leads to the sugar boom, which deposits more money in the coffers of London, allowing for a bigger navy to be developed, which allows London to then oust the Dutch from what is now New York City and the what are now the Mid-Atlantic states, creating more land to be exploited and necessitating more enslaved African labor, which then, in turn, allows poor Europeans to be recruited as a kind of policing force to monitor and surveil the enslaved Africans and to fight the indigenous for even more land. And therein, you begin to see this destructive, indeed apocalyptic process that eventuated in genocide against Native Americans and mass enslavement of Africans.
In chapter 2, No Providence for Africans and the Indigenous, which you've just been talking about, between 1629 and 1645, thousands of religious dissenters, notably Puritans, migrated to the Americas to escape tyranny. But just as men, women, and children from England endured bondage in North Africa while London abjured abolitionism, the Puritans and other so-called dissenters proceeded to impose a tyranny on the indigenous. Although indigens and Africans were the primary victims, in a manner that would bedevil settler colonialism for centuries to come, other settlers too were disfavored. So one of the questions, and I hate to keep drawing these parallels, but to me, that they need to be identified. The hypocrisy in the arguments needs to be identified. As you talk about, the Puritans migrated to the Americas to escape tyranny, but wound up being tyrants themselves. You got to ask Zionists in Israel after the Holocaust, and you complain about the Holocaust and how evil it was, you wind up imposing the same type of behavior on the Palestinians.
Well, it is ironic, isn't it? I mean, these so-called Puritans were religious zealots.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they discriminated against other religious formations, not least the religion of the Native Americans, which they deemed to be satanic. And in fact, even though the mythology suggests that they helped to construct this infant democracy in North America, actually it was more like an infant theocracy that they developed, which makes ironic the complaints about so-called theocracy emerging in other parts of the world in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, I think what happens is that people forget that this settlement process was not simply a way to try to find religious liberty. It was also a way to try to make money. Basically, the way to make money, of course, was enslaving others and taking their land. And in the first instance, this meant dispossession of the indigenous population of the Americas, and then trying to enslave them, finding difficulty in doing so because they knew the terrain, they could rally their neighbors to rebel. And that led to the fateful decision to take the turn towards mass enslavement of Africans.
We all talk about the spirit of 1776, but you write in chapter 7 about the spirit of 1676. Why? What was so important 100 years earlier that very few people want to talk about? You never hear about the spirit of 1676.
Well, in 1676, you had a major revolt of the indigenous population of what is now New England, particularly Massachusetts, which threatened to wipe out that particular settlement. Due south in Barbados, you had the Africans on the warpath threatening to wipe out that settlement. And in Virginia, I think I mentioned previously the revolt led by Nathaniel Bacon and Bacon's Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, this well-positioned European settler rallying the poor Europeans because he felt and they felt that London was not moving aggressively to seize the land of the Native Americans and redistribute it to poor Europeans. And therein, you begin to see what led to 1776. Which, as I say in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, was driven by the desire to evade the fact that London was moving towards abolition of slavery, per Somerset's case in 1772. And in the Royal Proclamation of 1763, London was trying to restrain the settlers from moving west, fighting the Native Americans and taking their land and forcing London to expend blood and treasure in the process. And so the settlers led by George Washington kicked out London and started their own country so they could continue and complete that process. 1676, you see the seeds of that process, and you also see the seeds of the construction of whiteness. That is to say, in order to overcome and overawe Native Americans and Africans, you needed more people. There just weren't enough English to go around. And so, therefore, you have the construction of this identity of whiteness, which allows you to draw upon a population base that stretches from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains deep into Russia. That is to say, they're warring on the shores of Europe, but once they come to North America, they magically take on this new identity, racial identity, that is whiteness. Eventually, that racial identity expands. Even Lebanese Christians like Ralph Nader, the presidential candidate, is viewed as white. Even Iranians, like the new head of Uber, is white.
Mm-hmm.
And the historians with their heads in the clouds have viewed this as part of an enlightenment, that people are becoming much more sophisticated. But actually, what was happening is that they needed more bodies to overawe and overcome rambunctious Native Americans and rebellious Africans. and inventing that new identity of whiteness was essential to that process.
You even have now, you have Hispanics that are considered, you know, that are considered white. In terms of Apocalypse Now, if one is searching for a year that marks the onset of the dawning of the apocalypse, 1688 is the date. For it was in that year the merchants completed what they had launched in the 1640s when the power and influence from settler colonialism propelled a revolt in London that led to the beheading of a king. You talk about the rise of the merchants and the power that earlier in the book, you talk about the rise of the merchants and the impact that the merchants had on slavery. If you could talk about that and then why 1688 is the dawning of the apocalypse.
Well, 1688 is the time and the day of the so-called Glorious Revolution, as it's still called in London, whereby there was revolt, particularly of the merchants, against the monarch, putting the monarch on a glide path to the figurehead status that Queen Elizabeth in London enjoys today. But as I tell the story, and to be fair, as other historians also have told the story, you can't understand that Glorious Revolution without understanding the fact that the merchants wanted a bigger slice of the wildly lucrative African slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind that in 1672, you had the formation of the Royal African Company under the thumb of the monarch. And per the Royal African Company, you can invest $1 and get a $1,700 profit. Now, there are people today who would sell their firstborn for a 1,700% profit. And certainly, this was a motivating factor causing the merchants to rise up against the monarch in 1688, which causes a deregulation of the African slave trade, allowing that trade to be deregulated, allowing more merchants to enter this wildly lucrative and odious commerce. They then begin to descend upon Africa with the maniacal energy of crazed bees, manacling and handcuffing every African in sight and dragging them across the Atlantic. Therein, you begin to see the development of the settlements in North America. Therein, you begin to see the rise of capitalism as well, because you need ships that need to be built in order to manacle and handcuff these Africans and drag them across the Atlantic. You need insurance companies because they have a tendency to revolt, and so you need insurance in case they succeed. And, of course, you need banks to finance all of this. And therefore, you see this economic engine that's being created based upon the African slave trade and enslavement. And per my previous comment, you also begin to see the acceleration and takeoff of white supremacy as well, because that serves as a rationalization for treating people in such a, quote, unchristian manner, unquote, because these people not only were not deemed to be Christian or not deemed to be human, they were deemed to be heathens,
mm-hmm.
but also those who were enslaving them were deemed to be on a higher rung of the evolutionary ladder because they were deficient of melanin.
You also talk about in the book, as you just touched on, this transition from the monarch to capitalism. And Oliver Cromwell was one of those who led this anti-monarch charge, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oliver Cromwell arose in the 1640s. As a part of a revolt against the divine right of kings and the right of monarchs,
mm-hmm.
the transition to what we now call republicanism, or mm-hmm. what in the United States is called democracy. That is to say that, at least thus far, the head of state is not a position that's transmitted genetically, so to speak. That is to say, we know that once Queen Elizabeth passes from the scene, presumably Prince Charles or Prince William will take her place as the head of state. Now, in the 17th century, a Prince Charles or a Prince William would not only be a figurehead, but the exact opposite. That is to say, a person wielding real power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it's fair to say that it was a step forward to make sure that the head of state, that position was not transmitted genetically. But what most analysts and historians ignore is that was intimately tied up with overthrowing the monarch's role in slavery and the African slave trade, and that with the decline of the power of the monarch and the rise of the power of the merchants, you had more individuals who were capable of exploiting Africa and Africans, not to mention Native Americans. And that's part of the story that I'm telling in this book.
And that let's do this. Let's go to James in Florida on one. James, good morning. You're going Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon and Dr. Gerald Horn.
Sit around, man, because somebody else got something. What kind of old shit is that?
James. James.
Okay, good morning.
Good. Head in the game, baby. Head in the game. Keep your head in the game. What's going on, man?
Okay. So I have a question. My question is, do you guys believe that every person of blacks that had the African outer appearance came to this country at that time by way of slavery? Do you believe that?
I don't, and let me defer to Gerald.
Well, the caller may want to look at my book, The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War, where I put forth the idea that many of the Melanesians who were kidnapped and engaged in bonded labor in the South Seas, that's like people of what is now Fiji, Papua New Guinea, et cetera, many of them wound up on the west coast of North America, and they're thought to be African Americans. The caller is probably referring to the work of Ivan Van Sertima that came before Columbus, and
right.
This whole idea that the Atlantic Ocean was sort of an escalator that could transport West Africans to the Americas. In my book, I talk about how Moroccans could be found off the coast of Newfoundland in the 1620s, for example, engaged in raiding and what might be called piracy. So I guess that speaks to the concern of the caller.
Does that answer your question, caller?
Yes, in a way, and I'm just going to touch on it, and then you guys can click me out. There are huge misconceptions because, see, I'm also a history buff, and I also studied American history as well as African history. So let's take New York, for example. The native people of New York were of African, they looked like Africans. So my question is, why is American history feeding this false narrative about slavery? No, all people of African color did not come to this country by way of slavery. The country and the people in the country at that time wasn't that big. There was, and they didn't have that many ships to bring over that many people.
Okay, I got it. I'm up against the clock. Let me let Gerald respond to that because I think we understand your point. Go ahead, Gerald.
Well, first of all, in terms of the Shinnecock people who populate Long Island, what is now called Long Island, many of them over the decades and centuries, like the Seminoles in Florida, basically merged with the African population in order to fight back against the settlers. So I'm not sure if you could just look at those people, even if you could find images from the 1600s, could you say that they look like they do today in 2018? Secondly, I don't think we should try to undercount, underplay, or somehow downplay the impact and dimensions of the African slave trade to act as if, which obviously downplays and diminishes the evil doing that led to going into Africa, manacling and handcuffing people and dragging them across the Atlantic, to act as if we came over here on our own agency. I mean, basically, which is sort of a sophisticated way of giving a pat on the back to a right-wing point of view.
Well, in fact, Gerald, man, you are so good. That takes us to our next caller, James in Philly, on two. James, good morning. You got about 45 seconds before I got to get out of here. Your question, please.
Yes, Dr. Leon?
Yep.
Okay, real quick. Well, Dr. Horn, the treatment of slavery by conservatives, and particularly black conservatives like Kwame Appiah and Walter Williams, who basically have said, and I've heard Walter Williams say this, that, you know, Africans, we should basically be glad that we were brought over here into this country. Him and Appiah have said that. And my question to you basically is that, can your book, that this book can be used as a counter against those guys? Would have you Have you ever been in the company or on a panel with Appiah or any of those guys? And what would you say to Appiah and Walter Williams in particular?
Well, anybody who makes that point of view, who tries to rationalize the horror and the apocalyptic nature of slavery and the African slave trade by saying that we should be happy we're in North America, I'm not even sure if that's worthy of a response.
Ben Carson even has said that. Ben Carson has said that.
Yeah.
And there's a notorious journalist for the Washington Post who has also said that, too, by the way. He was at the site of the Rwandan genocide, and as he witnessed this, he said, thank goodness for the African slave trade that rescued me from this Africa. But obviously what that does, it detaches the devastation that has routinely been visited upon in Africa as a result of colonialism and the slave trade. It makes it seem as if that devastation came solely and exclusively at the hands of Africans, and once again lets the white supremacists and the European colonialists and imperialists off the hook, which I guess brings you a nice paycheck, but does violence to historical understanding.
Thanks, James. We're at 59 past the hour. The apocalypse of settler colonialism, the roots of slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism in 17th century North America and the Caribbean. Dr. Gerald Horn, hey man, as always, thank you so much for your time and for your scholarship.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, man. Have a good weekend.
You too.
All right, folks. When we come back, we're going to bring that conversation into the here and now with my, I love this brother when he comes into the, well, I love him anyway, but when he comes to the studio, I love him even more. And we're going to bring it into the here and now on the other side of this break. But right now, Love Walked In, Lou Donaldson, 1962, Blue Note off of The Natural Soul. Keep it locked right here, Sirius XM 126, Urban View.